Your Hit Parade, starring Frank Sinatra.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
And now, smile a while with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
There's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden, and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by WTIC and Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank and their Cromwell Savings Bank Division. Hometown friends, serving your best banking interests in every way. Now, here's your host, Dick Bertel.
Good evening, and with me once again is radio historian collector Ed Corcoran. Well, Ed, who's our guest tonight?
We have a gentleman who was an instructor at the Central Connecticut State College in the speech department, and really one of the great pioneers in early television and radio, Jim Maloney.
Jim, it's good to have you with us here on the Golden Age of Radio. I'm a little bit dubious about your career in radio because You seemed to close an awful lot of radio shows, didn't you?
That's right. I put the lid on the coffin on two of the longest-running shows, the Aldrich Family and the Aunt Jenny Real Life Stories.
One of the reasons for that, of course, is that you arrived in New York in the late 40s, 1946,
I believe. It was 46, yes, and I came into New York. And at that time, radio was starting to phase out, and live television was coming in.
But you had experience on radio for many years. You were a local announcer, and then you went to Cleveland.
That's right. I was at the Cleveland Playhouse, which is a stock company there, a repertory company, playing the year-round. And while working there, rehearsing one play and playing another, as in stock, then I also worked at the WGAR, the local station there, and did quite a bit of radio broadcasting there.
When did you make the decision, which must have been a rather important decision, to go to New York?
I decided to go to New York in 46. I had a few dollars, not many, but a lot of courage.
And why did you make it?
Well, because the Playhouse was no longer right for me or me for it. I think partly it was because the war years were over and many of the people who had been regulars there were coming back. And also I got involved with a lot of other activities out there, like singing in the church on Sunday, teaching private pupils, and as they say, doing this radio work, too.
Jim, did you have any connections in New York?
No. Some of the Cleveland Playhouse people had gone on ahead of us, you know, and they were helpful. Like Dan Morgan was one of the actors from New York. Ray Walston worked with me, or I worked with him. We started together, as a matter of fact, at the Cleveland Playhouse. And people like that would tell you where to go, where the people to see, what to do, the ropes about making the rounds, and especially trying to get into the radio interviews.
Well, that was probably one of the most difficult things to accomplish, wasn't it?
Yes, because, again, there was some help. There was a director, producer named Ed Doer, that Ed Corcoran may remember, and he was there, and Al Ward, who now produces that medical center on TV, he was there, had been in Cleveland, so he was helpful. In fact, he got me on the American School of the Air, which was one of the earliest things I did.
Well, were you trying to get into radio or into the theater, or
the
both?
The theater mainly, but both, because they all work together, theater, television, radio, recordings, whatever you can get into.
But you did get some success at WNYC.
WNYC was a funny one, because I told you, some of the usually it worked with most people, it would be 50-50. You get 50% and you'd lose 50%. And some were very encouraging, others were, you know, why don't you go back to wherever you came from. But this particular one, I had an audition at WNYC, and it seemed like I hardly got home. The phone rang. Oh, yes, we definitely want you. Can you come so-and-so? Then I found out that there was no money involved there, that this was the municipal broadcasting station. However, it was a tremendous experience because they had an interesting show idea there. It was called One Step Forward, and they would take a famous person out of history and make a modern analogy based on his character. And one of the best parts I ever had was I played a man who was based on Mark Twain. And he was a, but it was set in the present day. Mm-hmm. And the idea that all these people had moved mankind one step forward. And as I say, I probably did, so I know a dozen or so of those broadcasts.
And they were professionally done.
Oh, yes, they were professional actors, but there wasn't any money involved. And the director was very good, and I think he went on to bigger and better things.
Were you able to make any connections as a result of those WNYC broadcasts?
No, I don't think they were directly responsible for anything. At that time, the leading person that the biggest obstacle to overcome was a woman named Frances von Bernardi, who was with Air Features. They had Gangbusters and FBI and Peace and War, most of the big shows. And if you could get through her, which unfortunately I didn't. But then there was another woman that was at one of the agencies, and it was one of the greatest interviews I had, and things seemed to be going swimmingly. And she called, fine, she was going to use me. And then nothing happened for a while. And I went back to the agency to see what had happened to this very promising interview. And the lady had been transferred to Chicago. Now, this is the kind of thing is the story of my life. There was another one, too. On many of these interviews, if they, you would be meeting like an office boy or an office girl rather than the person that you had hoped to see, because they would screen people. Now, obviously, they couldn't spend all their time listening to everybody who just got off the bus or train into New York City. So that this would go on. And after a while, I began to get a little sick of, you know, talking to somebody who could possibly do me no good at all. And so instead of doing the usual standard stuff where you do an old man, a young man, a New England type, a Midwestern type, and all the standard things that you would expect to do in radio broadcasting, I decided to do the stuff that I would do for the stage, stuff that I really enjoyed doing, like a scene from The Little Foxes and a scene from The White Steed, which is an Irish characterization. And so, of course, again, the story of my life, what happened then turned out to be not one of the office boys or office girls. It was Art Hanna, who was one of the biggest directors in the business. And he said it was very entertaining, but it wasn't really what he needed for radio.
Your timing was not the best. Huh?
Timing has never been very good.
Well, then along came Aunt Jenny.
Yes. Aunt Jenny, again, this was back in the early 40s. And that was one of the shows I said I put to bed, along with the Aldrich family. That was quite an experience because contact came from a director named Alan Potter. I see his name occasionally now on public TV as a producer and director. And he had been at the Canton Show Shop, where I had worked when I had my first professional job. And he had called me in on this. And it was kind of sad and sentimental evening. They kidded around a little bit. Like Jackie Kell said, Desert Stone, after how many years they've been together, they call me sometime, we'll have lunch, you know. But, and they had a little, not a big party, they just had a little quiet session. But it was a little bit sad to see the demise of a show that had been so prominent for so many years.
On this particular episode.
Don't blame me for killing me.
You weren't playing a regular character then.
This was a one-shot.
And it was the last show.
It just happened to be that.
Yeah. What sort of a part did you play? Do you remember?
I can't even remember that. But on the Aldrich Family TV, which started to phase in at the same time, a fellow named Bob Casey was playing Henry Aldrich. And in that, I played a policeman. I do remember that.
Yeah. Now, this also happened with Aunt Jenny. It was the last show?
It was the last week. I don't think it was exactly the last show. She was on 5 days a week, I believe, wasn't she?
Yeah, I think she it took a story on Monday, and then it took till Friday to complete it. Yeah. And they could have done it in 2 days, but it took five.
Actors must have dreaded seeing you come down the hall.
Yeah, I don't know. You have a cloud over your head.
Digger Odell.
Well, as long as we're talking about Aunt Jenny, suppose we resurrect that show from the past.
Yeah, this is a very popular soap opera, and in it you'll find a very famous singer as well as Aunt Jenny herself. And also Dan Seymour, the announcer, is also a very big-time executive in the advertising business today. So here is Aunt Jenny.
Time now for Spry's double feature treat of the day. Aunt Jenny's thrilling real-life story with Lanny Ross.
and fish fillets broiled to appetizing perfection with Spry. Well, friends, last night was certainly a big night here in Littleton. It was the night of our fine performance of the operetta Naughty Marietta, put on by the young folks of Littleton for the benefit of the hospital. And the wonderful part of it was, of course, that Lanny Ross, being here in town this week, sang the role of Captain Dick. I guess it was kind of an exciting evening for Lanny, too, what with the extra little problem that Connie Barcombe caused almost at the last minute. But suppose I start at the beginning, just before the curtain went up and the performance started last night. Calvin went backstage to say a word to Lanny.
Well, well, just a few minutes curtain time. How's everything going backstage here?
All right, I guess, Mr. Wheeler.
Uh-huh.
We're too nervous to know.
Oh, stage fright?
Yes.
Oh, well, you'll get over that when the curtain goes up. Where's Lanny Ross? I want a word with him.
Oh, over there with that mob around him.
Oh, thanks. Guess I'll have to kind of elbow my way in.
Hi there, Lanny.
Hi, Calvin. Now, you folks will excuse me for just a minute. Please, Desmond. Calvin, is there a good house out front?
I never knew you could pack so many people into this old auditorium, Lanny. Every seat and all the standing room sold.
Good.
That's a mighty fine thing you're doing for Littleton, Lanny. It was your name that drew this kind of a crowd, you know.
I'm glad to do it. Now, let's hope there'll be a great big check for the Littleton Hospital out of this night's work.
Oh, there will be. Tell me, when are you leaving town, Lanny?
Right after the show. The late train, Calvin.
Naughty Marietta certainly shot your fishing trip all to smithereens, didn't it?
Next time I come to Littleton, I'm going to fish.
5 minutes till the overture starts, everybody. 5 minutes!
Oh, dear. Well, I better get back to my seat.
Yes.
I don't want to miss any of this show, Lanny.
Yes. I wonder...
Were you looking for somebody?
Connie Barcombe. Funny thing, I haven't seen her.
Uh-huh. Well, I'll be around after the show.
Yes. Mm-hmm. See you later. Connie. Connie Barcombe.
Has
anybody seen Connie Barcombe?
Somebody saw her sitting on the fire escape a minute ago, Mr. Ross.
Which fire escape?
That way, Mr. Ross.
Thank you very much. Connie, what are you doing out here? It's almost curtain time.
Hello, Lanny.
Are you crying?
Uh-uh.
You certainly are. What's the matter?
Oh, Lanny, I'm in the most awful mess.
Again?
Yes, again. Seems like I always jump right out of the skillet into the fire.
All right, come on now, tell me. What's the trouble?
Oh, it's all my own fault again.
Maybe if I knew what it was. Come on, Connie. We're friends, aren't we?
Well, that's part of my trouble. First I was in a mess because you weren't my friend. Now I'm in a mess because you are. Isn't it silly?
Well, it's a little confusing, anyhow.
Oh, it's Hal Moyer. We were engaged, you know.
No, I didn't know, but I'm glad. Hal Moyer's a nice boy.
I told him I talked to you about going back to New York and trying again for the stage. And he said...
He said what?
He said, go ahead.
Oh.
He broke our engagement just like that. He doesn't want to stand in my way.
Well, I call that right decent of him, don't you?
I suppose so.
But if your way to your career is clear, and that's what you want, what's the trouble? Let's have it.
Oh, Lanny, you said yesterday... A career is no good unless you're willing to give up absolutely everything else in the world that stands in your way.
Well, what do you want more than anything else in the world, Connie?
I want to stay right here in Littleton and marry Hal. Now I practically have to go to New York.
Why?
Well, do you think I'm going to let Hal Moyer think I haven't any strength of character? Hal said, go on back to New York. And I said, all right, if that's all you care.
Lanny Ross!
Right here.
The train goes up in 1 minute.
Oh, thank you. Come on, Connie. Cheer up if you can. We'll try to figure out something later.
Well, there's nothing more to figure out, thank you. I'm going back to New York. My family's agreed and everything. I even have my ticket.
Aunt Jenny, going back to the late 1940s. Our guest tonight is Jim Maloney. We'll get back to him right after this message.
Perhaps 1976 is the year you've decided to improve your home's exterior appearance. Maybe it's a new driveway you need, or a complete landscaping job with new plantings for the front of your home. Or now, with warm weather, the desire to own your own swimming pool or backyard patio may be stronger than ever. If that's the case, stop in and get complete information on a home improvement loan from the folks at Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank or Cromwell Savings Bank Division.
Cromwell Savings Bank is located at the corner of Main and West Street and at the Cromwell Plaza office next to Kmart in Cromwell, with convenient Saturday hours, 9 to noon. And Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank has four offices to serve you, two in Middletown and branches in Montville and Colchester. With the exception of the Middletown office on Main Street, they are also open Saturdays from 9 to noon. Stop in soon. Let them show you how a home improvement loan may take the cramp out of your family's lifestyle. Member FDIC, an equal housing lender. And now back to Dick Bertel.
Jim Maloney is our guest. Jim is now an instructor in theater at Central Connecticut State College. We're talking about his days in radio, and we're going to be getting into the early days of TV in just a couple of minutes. But one of the shows that you did appear on, and this was probably one of the classic shows in radio, I'm sure you'll agree to that, Ed, and that was the Columbia School of the Air, Jim.
Yes, I did a version of Treasure Island on that, and this was produced and directed by Al Ward that I mentioned before, who had come from Cleveland. And it was quite remarkable there to see all these trained radio people who would do two and three parts. And there was especially, I remember, an actor named Bob Dryden. Excuse me, he was probably just in his early 20s, but he did Long John Silver, and I think he did a couple of other parts along with that. He probably even did The Parrot.
Well, of course, you had to double in those days.
Yes.
You, I know you worked with Ed Begley in Inherit the Wind. We'll get to that a little later, but did you ever work with Ed on radio?
No, I don't believe I did. We didn't really cross paths here, because when I was first working at WNBC, they had studios both in New Britain and Hartford. He was in Hartford. And even though we might cross each other on the airwaves, I never met him until much later in New York City,
mm-hmm.
when we got together when he did Inherit the Wind. And Ed was mentioning earlier, one of the most famous things that Ed did was Patterns. And during the run of Inherit the Wind, in which he played the character based on William Jennings Bryan, he had let his hair grow long back and on the sides for the character. But then he had to have the hair cut when they were going to do the film version of Patterns, which he was doing at the same time. It was in the daytime he was working on Patterns, at night and matinees he was doing Inherit the Wind. So he bought a fall, that is a piece of hair that fits around the sides and in the back and takes the place of his regular hair. Now, although Ed had been an actor for many years, he'd been mostly a radio actor, and he didn't know much about stage makeup and wigs and so on. And I'd done almost nothing but that, you know, maybe playing over 300 parts in stock in maybe over a dozen years or so. So he hired me as his dresser. So we had a lot of fun during the run of the show, because he and Tony Randall were in the same dressing room. So we had just great times as I talked there. And Ed was very good to me. And he took me out to dinner many times. And incidentally, Tony Randall has also been very good to me when getting me jobs only in Hollywood. Connections, of course, are very important. And some people, of course, aren't too helpful to others. But both Ed and Tony Randall are classic examples of actors not being jealous at all, but being helpful with other people.
Can you recall the story of Ed when he forgot his lines in Inherit the Wind?
Yes. Well, you know, Ed had a very booming voice. And at this particular time, he was, as I say, a character based on William Jennings Bryan, and it's set in the monkey trial, the Scopes trial, where the young teacher is on charge for had been arrested for teaching evolution. And so William Jennings Bryan comes to prosecute, and Clarence Darrow, played by Paul Muni, was the one who came to defend the boy. And at the beginning of the play, there's a big scene where all the townspeople are welcoming Ed, who is William Jennings Bryan.
Mm-hmm.
I played the mayor of the town. And then we just get the word, just comes that Clarence Darrow is going to enter the fray. And I get all excited about it. And I said, maybe we should do something about it, maybe call the Board of Health, some stupid thing like that. And Ed said, no. When the enemy sends his champion into the fray, it welcomes our food. And to this day, we're still trying to know how Belcom's our crew mates.
Nobody broke up.
Oh, yes, yes.
Oh, you did.
The audience, are they laughed too, or is it covered up?
No, I get, you know, just
they just thought it was a part of the dialogue.
So just some people readjusted their hearing aids.
But the actors, they caught it, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But I don't think they broke up at that. They probably broke up as soon as they got off stage.
That's a marvelous story.
Well, you talk about connections. I wonder, when you joined the Lambs Club, whether this didn't greatly increase your availability as an actor when you were in New York.
Yes. The Martin Caine show, particularly. Mickey Alpert, who had the dubious distinction of being the master of ceremonies at that Coconut Grove fire in Boston, mm-hmm. was the casting director for the Martin Caine show. And as I say, I probably played about 7 different times on that show.
There were a lot of famous actors in the Lambs Club. Isn't that what it's made up of?
Yes, it was, of course, originally, you know, for the stage actors. But then a great many of the people were on the radio in those days, like Les Tremaine. I believe you had Les on your show.
Yeah, he was on the show about a year ago, yes. Yeah. He's out of Hollywood now.
He was on the Steve Allen broadcast.
And you had Mr. District Attorney and his associate,
Ed Harrington. Latimer. I think Jay Johnston by that time was in California. I knew him up there, and I worked with him in a play at the Maskers Club, which is the equivalent of the Lambs out on the West Coast. It was formed by the New York actors when they went out to do films.
Well, you know, the names that you mention are all names that we recognize today. One of them is Art Hannis. Now, Art was the announcer on the Sullivan Show, wasn't
he? That's right. And he had to work with us at WJR in Cleveland. He wasn't an actor. He was a straight announcer, but I knew him very well for the 3 years that I was there.
Did announcers and actors tend to get together very much, those in radio and TV and so on?
Well, certainly at the Lambs Club, because you have people like Ed Hurley, who was there. Vince Scully was a member of the Lambs Club, and I think Mal Allen was, or at least he was around there a great deal. A great man, Charles Mountain, was, a lot of the announcers were.
Now, Did you begin to sense that radio was fading, or were you simply enamored of television? What was the transition like, Jim?
Well, the main thing, as I said, is I was interested in the stage, as most actors would rather be on the stage than anything else. And you took the others, well, what you could, the bread and butter jobs, whatever you could get in radio, television, recordings, whatever it might be.
All right, but you did start to move into TV.
I didn't have any great philosophy about TV is the wave of the future, and I'm going to get in on the ground floor. No, I wouldn't say that.
Mm-hmm. But when did opportunities begin to
Well, the TV,
open up for
almost
you?
Right away. Almost right away. As a matter of fact, I was on the Love of Life television show when that was live, too, with all the headaches that accompany live television, and for about a year and a half, and I was also in a show at the same time.
Mm-hmm. How early did you get into TV?
Well, it's hard to say. I would say we would be in the early 50s or even earlier. I don't remember exactly when TV
It would seem that stage actors would be more in demand for television than radio actors because it's more than speaking lines. It has to be the presence, knowing what to do and how to move and everything.
That's true.
It must have been a bonanza if you had that experience to be able to come in there.
Yes. Having the stock experience, especially where you have to learn parts in a very short time.
What were the pressures like? What were the real pressures on an actor with early live TV?
Well, one thing, the sets had to be permanent. The sets were already up, scattered all over, would look like an aircraft hangar.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so an actor may have to scoot from one of those to the other, maybe making a quick change en route. There are the other complications where the just the sheer physical danger from the microphone booms and the cameras that were scooting all around. And that was a tremendous, for the actors, it was difficult enough, but for the directors of television, they had to stay up all night, not just figuring how the scene should play, the tempo or anything like that, but where are those cables going to go? How can I have camera 3 cross over to set 7 without cutting the cables on the microphones for for Mike, too. I don't know how they ever did it. It was tremendous. There was also the danger, too, of the wrong camera clicking on or a dead body getting up while the...
Did you ever have any experiences
they say that
like
happened
that?
To me, but I got it. That was on the Martin Caine show. Or
what
I,
types
I
of
played
parts?
The part of a ticket collector in a theater, and he got shot. And they say that I get out, but I doubt that very much. But it did happen to other people, and also the leading ladies behind a screen making a quick change with the whole country watching them getting out of their clothes. You know, those kinds of things could happen. And, of course, the dreadful thing was when an actor dried up completely.
Yeah.
When an actor dries up on the stage, usually somebody senses it right away and can cover for it, make up some lines. But there was a horrendous experience on one of the Philco shows, I think it was. There was an actor that I got to know later whose name shall be mercifully unmentioned. But he had the denouement, the whole resolution of a mystery show. And all of a sudden they asked him, and he just, suddenly that film, that glassy look came into the eye, and nothing. And I don't know how they ever got out of that. Nobody ever knew about it. Nobody ever found out who done it.
Yeah, network trouble about that time, I guess. That's the best way to handle it.
Well, actors do have to bail out other actors on TV, I'm sure. There's no question about that. In live TV, that is.
Yes, and of course on the stage. One of the funniest experiences I had in that was when a woman playing opposite me in the show was playing a mother, I was playing a father, and she lost her lines. And I covered magnificently. I was complete master of the situation. And with a great aplomb, I covered it all for her. And then I went over to the fireplace where I was supposed to take a taper and light my pipe. Forget it. My hand was shaking so badly after the situation that I couldn't even find the pipe to light it.
There must be a real psychological change in the person, isn't it, when that happens? When all of a sudden you're thrust in the limelight and you've got to cover it.
The movies, of course, are different than so-called live on tape. Although with the tape, they try to keep going. And it's not a complete disaster. Yeah. But the movies, you do it little snippets, so it's much, much easier. As George Burns said, with good actors on either side of you, you don't have to remember the lines.
We were talking earlier about the Aldrich family, and I think it's about time that we played an excerpt from that show. You were indicating you were on the very last show, and there was a kind of a sadness in the air about it. Actors who had been playing opposite each other for 10 years or more, I guess.
Yes, I think it's longer than that.
Yes, it was on that length of time. And this was done after the war when all the original casts were back in place. And this was a very good show. And I think you haven't heard before, the audience will really enjoy it.
Henry Aldrich.
Coming, Mother.
Yes, it's the Aldrich family, based on characters originated by Clifford Goldsmith and starring Ezra Stone as Henry with Jackie Telk as Homer. When you take a typical American family, plus some friends and neighbors, and then add one teenage boy, you needn't bother to stir things up. The boy, if he's like Henry Aldrich, will somehow attend to that. The scene opens in the Aldrich living room. The time is late afternoon.
No, Homer, I think you don't have to.
You do? I don't?
Definitely not.
Boy, Hen, I hope you're right. I've been saving for 2 months to get a new band for my wristwatch. And now if I had to... Suppose she expects me to.
She couldn't.
How do you know?
I'll bet Agnes doesn't even know it's the anniversary of your first date with her.
Do you really think so, Hen?
Sure. Who remembers things like that? My father never does. I'm surprised you even thought of it.
Boy, I'll never forget it.
Well, okay, Homer, you have a special reason for remembering your anniversary, but Agnes doesn't, does she?
Gee, maybe you're right, Hen. And boy, is that a load off my mind.
Sure.
Sure. Now I can concentrate on my wristwatch.
Sure.
Do you think I ought to get a brown leather band, Hen, or a black one?
I thought I heard voices in here.
Hi, Mother.
Hi, Mrs. Aldrich.
Hello, boys, and congratulations, Homer.
Thank you, Mrs. Aldrich. What for?
Isn't Saturday an anniversary of some kind?
Oh.
Your very first date with Agnes, isn't it?
Hen.
Gee whiz, Mother, how did you know?
I was out shopping this morning, and I ran into Agnes.
Oh.
So my heartiest congratulations to the both of you, Homer, and many happy returns.
Thank you, Mrs. Aldrich.
Thank you, Mother.
You're welcome, boys. If you want some fruit, it's in the icebox.
Who could eat fruit now? See, Henry?
So what? So my mother knows. What does that prove?
It proves Agnes knows.
All right, supposing Agnes does know. What does that prove?
It proves there goes my watch band.
Not necessarily.
Alice, you know where... Hello, boys.
Hi, Father.
Hi, Father. I mean Mr. Aldrich.
Oh, by the way, Homer, I ran into a friend of yours down at the Emporium today.
You did, Mr. Aldrich?
Agnes.
Oh. May I ask in what department?
I believe it was in Ladies Unmentionables.
Oh.
Is your mother in the kitchen, Henry?
I think so, Father.
See you later, boys.
Well, that does it.
Homer, why do you keep jumping at conclusions?
I'm not jumping at them, Hen. They're jumping at me.
I still don't see it.
Then what was Agnes doing in Ladies Unmentionables?
I don't know. Maybe she was just looking around.
Sure, and I know why.
Why?
To see what she could exchange what I'm going to give her for.
Hello?
Hello, Henry. Is Homer there?
Yeah, he is, Agnes.
Agnes? Oh.
Let me talk to him.
Okay. Here, Homer.
Hello, Agnes.
Hello, Homer, honey.
Oh, boy. Agnes, is there any special reason you asked me to come over to your house?
No, Homer, I was just lonely.
Oh.
Isn't it wonderful, Homer? Another wonderful, thrilling year.
Sure.
And, Homer, I just want you to know that I don't expect a thing as an anniversary present.
You don't?
Of course not. I have you. What more could I ask for?
Nothing, Agnes.
Another year, and we're still together. That's all any girl needs to make her happy, her man.
Sure. Don't you think a brown band would go better with my wristwatch than a black?
And anyway, I don't think it's fair for a girl to expect a boy to spend all his money on her.
Sure. That's what I like about you, Agnes. You're so fair.
Sure. $4 or $5 ought to be plenty.
Oh.
Homer.
What?
Give me a hint.
I can't.
Why?
Because.
Because why?
Just because.
Homer Brown, haven't you decided yet what you're going to get me?
Well, sort of.
Sort of? What does that mean?
Henry's supposed to be thinking of something.
Oh. Homer?
What?
Get Henry on the phone and find out what you're going to give me.
But Agnes...
Here, start talking.
Yes, ma'am. Hello, operator. Give me Elm 431.
Now, remember, Homer, I don't want you to spend a cent over $4 or $5.
Yes, Agnes.
Unless you promise you'll get me something cheaper for my birthday.
Oh. Hello, Hen. This is Homer. Did you think of anything yet?
Uh-huh.
What? But, Hen. Well, yeah, I know, but...
Uh-huh.
I suppose so, Hen.
Yeah.
Bye, Hen.
Well?
We want it to be a surprise, Agnes.
A surprise? Homer, that's wonderful. I just love surprises. What is it?
You'll see.
Is it something I can wear?
Maybe.
I'll bet it's something I can eat. Is it, Homer?
Maybe.
No, it's something I can wear. I'm sure of it. Is it?
Maybe.
Homer, give me a hint.
I can't.
Why?
Henry said you'd try to force it out of me so he wouldn't even tell me.
Couldn't you think of something that'd still leave Homer enough for the watch band?
I tried to, Mother, but a watch band would only leave Agnes 45 cents. You can't get much for that.
No, I imagine not.
Besides, I think the dozen roses will be very appropriate.
Poor Homer.
Yeah, he sure wanted that watch band.
Maybe this will teach him to change girls at least once a year.
Boy, if I only had a little more money, I'd buy him that watch band myself.
I'll tell you what I'll do, Henry. Since it's Homer's anniversary, I'll match whatever you put up. How much do you have in your dime bag?
A dime.
Well, Well, that gives us 20 cents.
I'll match what both of you put up.
There, 40 cents. How much more do we need?
About 60.
60, eh?
The milk bottles. Henry, there are 5 empty ones on the back porch.
That's another quarter, only 35 cents more.
Maybe if we looked under the sofa pillow.
Sure.
Henry, my pillow.
A dime! I found a dime!
Look in the corner there, Henry. There's something shiny.
Another dime. Father, did you lose a suspender button?
There's a nickel, Henry, and 2 pennies.
Here's another nickel. That's 10, 17, 22.
13 cents short.
Wait, I know what.
What?
I'll only buy Agnes 11 roses.
Fine, we've made it.
I'll go right down to the jeweler's now and get Homer his watch band.
Good.
You think I ought to have something engraved on it? Something like success?
Henry, this is the anniversary of Homer's winning Agnes, not the Kentucky Derby.
The Aldrich Family, and it is good to hear that show once again. Our guest tonight is Jim Maloney. We'll get back to his story right after this.
The Cromwell Savings Bank, division of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank, located on Main Street in Cromwell, has been serving the people of Cromwell with every banking need since 1871. And it was just 1 year ago last Monday that the Cromwell Plaza office opened its doors to serve you as well in the old neighborly Cromwell tradition. At either Cromwell Savings Bank division, you'll find the same friendly and dependable service, the same personal attention on all your banking needs, and both offices are open Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 12 noon for your convenience. The first and oldest Cromwell Savings Bank office is at the corner of Main and West Streets. It's open Monday through Wednesday from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., Thursdays from 9 to 5, and Fridays from 9 to 7:30. The newer Cromwell Plaza office is conveniently located next to Kmart and is open Monday through Wednesday from 10 to 4:30, Thursday from 10 to 5, Friday from 10 to 7:30. In addition, you'll find plenty of free and convenient parking adjacent to both Cromwell Savings Bank division offices of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank. Stop in soon. They look forward to serving your family for the next 100 years. Member FDIC. And now, once again, back to Dick Bertel.
Jim Maloney is our guest. Jim is an instructor in speech and theater at Central Connecticut State College now. We're recalling his days in radio, on the stage. And now we're going out to Hollywood, because you made that decision in about the mid-50s, somewhere in 1955.
That's right. I was in the play Inherit the Wind, as I said, with Ed Begley. And Paul Muni was the star of that production, playing the character based on Clarence Darrow. Well, the show was a little dubious at first, I thought, because I thought it was kind of academic. Here was 1954, 55. It was based on a trial of 1925, the Scopes Monkey Trial, so-called, where the boy was arrested for teaching evolution. But it turned out to be a tremendous success, and especially a personal success for Ed Begley and Paul Muni. And originally the show was going to run on Sundays, which meant they were doubtful about it. Mm-hmm. And so as soon as it got to be a hit, it became a hot ticket, they changed and went to the regular routine of Monday through Saturday with matinees on Wednesday and Saturday. And we're just sailing along, just as they say in the trade, sending out our laundry, getting established, knowing that we had a hit. Then Paul Muni had a problem. He had a cancer and lost an eye.
Oh, I remember that very well.
The show closed, and Herman Shumlin, who was the producer, was desperate to find somebody to take his place. He wanted the show to go. He approached Frederick March, Edward G. Robinson, Claude Rains, all the important character actors at the time, but none of them wanted to take the challenge of following in Muni's footsteps, and because he'd made such a tremendous personal success. Then Shumlin had a brainstorm. There was a very fine actor named Melvin Douglas, who up to that time had been known just as a suave leading man playing opposite Joan Crawford, Greta Garbo, and so on in the movies. But he had been a good stock actor years ago, and he took on the challenge and did a marvelous job. So the show had opened with Paul Muni, closed for a few days, reopened with Melvin Douglas, which was to a tremendous success. Then after he'd been playing it, I don't know how long, 2 or 3 months, Muni had an artificial eye in place. And he got his courage back, and they induced him to come back into the show. But he didn't want to make any big fuss about it. So what happened was, on a particular night, like a Tuesday night, just in the middle of the week, Melvin Douglas stepped out in front of the curtain on that night, the audience expecting to see him. The Actors' Equity Association has a rule that an actor in an important role is replaced, an announcement, public announcement, should be made to that effect. And tonight, Melvin Douglas will not appear. The part of Henry Drummond will be played by Paul Muni. Of course, they went wild all over again. So that was the third opening night, each time with a tremendous ovation, with a tremendous emotional charge, and all the nervousness that goes with it. So then the show ran for about 15 months total at that time. And then they decided to close for the summer and get through the hot weather and reopen in about 8 weeks. And I said, no, I can't take another opening night of Inherit the Wind. Now is the time to pick up stakes and go to Hollywood, because the television had moved out there. Television had started primarily in Chicago, as you know, then moved into New York, and then eventually had gone out to the coast. And so I went out then, and then for the next 8 years I did feature movies and television and stage work, too.
You were involved in a number of big television shows, including Twilight Zone?
That's right, Twilight Zone, The Wagon Train.
Tell me, which Twilight Zone did you do?
The one, strangely enough, that seemed to be repeated more often than any other, it was called A Stop at Willoughby, and James Daly was the star of it. It was about a man who was involved in the rat race in New York, the business, and was having troubles at home. And when he's on the train and is semi-dozing on his way out to the suburbs where he lives, suddenly the character of the train changes, and instead of being a present-day train, it's a train of about 50, 60 years ago. Mm-hmm. And there's a conductor on there who calls out to stop Willoughby, which is not on the regular line. And that was the part I played. And this conductor was a very nice part, because he was kind of a death symbol, a death wish that this man had. He wanted to get off the train, get off the world, stop the world, I want to get off. So he was kind of a philosopher, and it was a nice little part.
Yeah. Did you do any feature movies while you were out there?
Well, I had done the play Detective Story with Ralph Bellamy, mm-hmm. and when they made the film version of that, they brought five of us who had played in it in New York to do the film version. One of those was Lee Grant, who made such a success as the Shoplifter and who won the Academy Award the other night. Horace McMahon was passed on, unfortunately. It was another one of them.
Yeah, Louis Van Ruten, he was another one.
Louis, he played in the film, but he wasn't in the stage version.
Huh?
He played the part that Lou Gilbert had played on the stage. But the two thugs, Joe Wiseman and Michael Strong, were from the stage version. That was the five.
Do you ever get to see yourself on reruns?
Yes, they keep popping up. In fact, the Detective Story was on just a short while ago. As I said, that Stop at Willoughby seems to be on very frequently. As a matter of fact, in my class yesterday, one of the girls said, "Were you on The Real McCoys?" I said, "Yes, a couple of times." "I saw you," said. "I couldn't believe it." The funny thing, you know, the people don't believe actors go any place except that they're in that tube or they're in that little radio box. You know, they don't go out and eat. Many times when I was with Ed Begley, you'd see the same scene would be repeated. Husband and wife at the table, and the wife would say, "That's Ed Begley." And he would marry me and say, "Don't be ridiculous." I know why it's so ridiculous, you know? But this is what would happen. And one of the women insisted, and she came up to Ed, and she said, "Mr. Begley, oh, I've loved all your work, especially what was the name of that picture you did with Edgar G. Robinson?" And Ed said, and Ed had a habit of putting his hand over his face, kind of patting his mouth a little bit, "Edward G. Robinson? Never." "That's it." "Oh, that's it. That was a wonderful movie."
Well, now, we're going to hear an excerpt from your collection, Ed, of It Pays to Be Ignorant. And how do you fit into this picture, Jim?
I fit into it like a motorman's glove, as they say. One of the things was that they would have stooges. People who would just come, they'd give them crazy questions, you know, like who was buried in Grant's tomb and so on. And then the different members, Lulu McConnell, Harry McNaughton, George Shelton, would make fun or kid around, like the Lulu McConnell, you know, pretend that she wanted to have a date with me and call me honey and that kind of stuff. And so for $5 or $10, this was one of the things you do when you first go to New York. But I did get to know George Shelton very well later on, as a member of the Lambs Club.
What was the show it was patented after? Do you recall the why did they name it Pace the Ignorant? Was there another show?
Just information, please.
Yeah, it was just the opposite. In other words, instead of knowing everything, they knew nothing.
They knew nothing, and of course the questions were stupid, and they would kick it around. And Harry McNaughton was the British actor, and he had the slow take, remember?
Oh, yes.
Yes, that someone would tell a joke, and then a little while later...
start laughing, yes.
You know.
Yeah, wasn't he Phil Baker's stooge at one time? I think they worked together.
Beale and Bottle.
He was he was Bottle, I believe.
Yes, and Beetle, I think, was a New Britain man, Humphrey Muldowney.
Okay, well, we've talked about the show, Dick. Why don't we listen to it now and see how it sounds?
Okay.
Mr. Hard, we have a very charming young lady. Her name is Miss Eunice Wilde.
Oh, well, fine. How do you do, Miss Wilde? How are you this evening?
Fine, thank you, Mr.
Howard. Well, are you alone, Miss Wilde? Are you alone?
What do you mean? What difference does it make to you if she's alone or not?
Mr. Hard, it's not much fun for the young lady in New York alone, you know.
Uh-huh.
You should have an escort.
I see. And I suppose you would be the escort?
Well,
yes.
You put it rather bluntly, Miss
I see.
You better be careful what you say, Mr. McNaughton. Suppose your wife is listening in.
Oh, I fixed that.
Oh.
I took the tubes out of the radio before I left home.
I see.
I also got rid of my antenna.
Oh, you did?
How long has antenna been with you?
Ah, antenna been with you. So are you married?
No, I'm not. I'm single.
Oh, well, then your husband is not with you.
No.
You're not married, naturally. Well, we're very glad to have you. You say you've heard the program before.
Oh, yes, all the time.
Tell me, what do you do for a living?
I'm a receptionist in a textile office.
Oh, in textile. That's cloth and things like
that's
that.
That's right.
That,
right? Mm-hmm.
How do you like the work?
Yeah, oh, I felt that all right.
I see. Well, it certainly is nice to have you with us here. How long have you been working in textile?
About 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And you're not married?
No.
Well, I almost got married once, Mr. Howard.
You almost got married?
Yeah.
Almost?
Yeah, I used to meet a very nice girl in the subway every evening.
Yeah.
I was almost going to marry her.
What happened?
Well, you see, she used to get off at 72nd Street, and I used to get off at 84th Street.
Well, why didn't you marry her?
Oh, she was below my station.
She... What are you laughing at?
This is his cold cream.
His cold cream. Miss Wilde, I'm going to ask you before. We're running a little short on time. So would you reach into the cap there and pick out a question for us as long as you're here? And would you be good enough to read the question if you don't mind? Just read it into our mic.
In the book Robinson Crusoe, what was the name of the leading character?
Thank you. In the book Robinson Crusoe, what was the name of the leading character?
Mr. Hart, isn't this a question about books?
Yes, it is.
I'm writing a book now, you know.
It is.
I'm writing a book. It's a sequel to The Naked City.
A sequel to The Naked City?
Yes, it's called Bear Mountain.
Please. In the book Robinson Crusoe, what was the name of the leading character? Any schoolboy should know the answer.
But I never went to school, Mr. Hart.
I know that.
I started right at college.
You started right into college?
Why bother with the middleman?
Oh, I see. What college did you ever go?
I don't remember. It was either Penn State or State Penn.
Yeah.
I know they didn't use names for the students, just numbers.
Just numbers.
What did you go to college for, Mr. Shelton?
To get polished.
Well, where is it?
I drank it. Yes. To speak about college, my grandfather had a sad death. He died from drinking shellac.
He died from drinking shellac?
Yeah, but he had a fine finish.
Yeah. Please, the story of Robinson Crusoe is about a man who at the age of 13 ran away from home and went to sea. He was shipwrecked on a barren island on which lived nothing but cannibals.
Well, I knew a cannibal's daughter once.
You did?
Yeah, you know, funny thing about her, she liked the boys better when they were stewed.
When they were stewed. Mr. Sheldon.
How did this man manage to live, Mr. Howard?
He lived off the animals on the island.
Oh, my, lived off a poor little animal. Was he able to support himself?
Oh, please, that's silly. He trapped the animals and used them for food.
Mr. Howard, tell me, you say this man was shipwrecked.
Yeah.
How did he get to the island in the first place?
He made a raft with his bare hands.
Must be awfully hard to make a raft out of bare hands. Well, of course, he had the nails.
He had the nails.
They were right. No, they were right at the end of his palm.
Never mind. Let's get on with this thing. He had the nails. One day while strolling around the island, he saw smoke.
The island must have been on fire.
I see.
Maybe it was Fire Island.
All right. The smoke was coming over a hill, so he climbed up the hill, and what do you suppose he saw?
The other side of the hill.
Please. He saw fire.
He did? You know, I'll bet that's where the smoke was coming from.
Miss McNaughton, you're wonderful. Your deductions are wonderful.
Not only that, they're repulsive.
They were cannibals. Cannibals was dancing around this fire.
Oh, cannibals.
Yes.
Ooh, I thought they were mosquitoes because they bite worse than mosquitoes.
Okay, in the middle of these cannibals, there was a man.
Who was the man?
The man was Friday.
I know, but who was the man?
I told you, Friday.
What are you talking about? I didn't see you Friday.
The cannibals were dancing around Friday.
Don't you see, Miss McConnell? The cannibals were dancing on Friday.
I don't care what day they were dancing. Who was the man?
Please, they were dancing around this man. They were getting ready to eat him.
Eat who?
They were going to eat Friday.
You mean they only eat on Friday? I bet they had fish for dinner.
Well, you know, that's a funny thing. I had fish today.
You did?
Yeah, I had a fried omatter.
What's the matter?
Nothing. What's the matter with you?
Ah! That's wrong, Harry. You guys are making this thing worse.
Yes, I know.
Yes.
Is it possible? How big a fellow was this?
He was 6 feet tall, so when he saw this horrible thing, he stopped short.
How could he stop short if he was 6 feet tall?
No. But who was the man?
Please, he was Robinson Crusoe's man, Friday.
But whose man was he the rest of the week?
Ah, that's right.
It pays to be ignorant. And that takes us back a good many years. We'll get back to our guest, Jim Maloney, in just a moment.
Tomorrow's dreams will be financed with today's savings. And when you open a savings account at Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank or its Cromwell Savings Bank division, you not only get a variety of savings plans to choose from, you also get the greatest interest available by law. What's more, the passbook they give you may be used at any of their 6 conveniently located offices. Build a solid foundation for your future with a savings account at Cromwell Savings at the corner of Main and West Street or the Cromwell Plaza office next to Kmart in Cromwell. Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank has 4 offices to serve you, 2 in Middletown and branches in Montville and Colchester. Stop in soon. All offices are open Saturdays from 9 to noon except the Farmers and Mechanics Main Street office in Middletown. In addition to the convenience of one-stop banking and convenient hours, you'll also find plenty of free parking. Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank and Cromwell Savings Bank Division are members of FDIC.
Jim Maloney, our guest. Jim is an instructor in speech and theater at Central Connecticut State College. And Jim, can you tell us just a little bit about what you're doing there?
Well, one of the courses I have in theater is the musical theater. I've been a musical theater buff all my life. The first Broadway show I saw was Music in the Air. That was about 1932. And I see everything I possibly can. Just last week I saw a preview of the revival of My Fair Lady in New York, which is a tremendous production. I did some work in musicals. I did The Song of Norway out in the Los Angeles and San Francisco with Patrice Wansel. And then I did Guys and Dolls at Las Vegas for 7 months with Dan Daly and Betty Grable. And so I've made up quite a collection, and I'm not in a class with Robert E. Smith, but I do have a collection of show music that I play for the kids. And I also have some slides that I had made up that show the musical theater starting around Civil War time up to the present day.
That sounds like a great course. Well, Jim, I want to thank you for sharing your career with us here on the Golden Age of Radio tonight. I've enjoyed the stories. They've been very, very amusing and have given us even more insight into that wonderful era. Jim Maloney, our guest. And until next time, this is Dick Bertel.
This is Ed Corcoran.
Good night.
The Golden Age of Radio has been brought to you by WTIC and Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank and their Cromwell Savings Bank Division. Hometown friends serving your best banking interests in every way. The Golden Age of Radio was produced by Bob Sherrago and Dick Bertel.
Rinse so white and rinse so bright.
Broadcasting from New York City, Jack Benny with Mary Livingston, Bill Harris, Rochester, Dennis Day, and...
A dancing program from the Paradise Restaurant.